Good morning, everyone. It's great to see everybody. I'm going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Bonner. As you know, I'll be retiring, and I want to make sure that our younger members have some experience chairing committees. I think it is very helpful for them. I did not have that experience before I became a chair with the gavel, so I know how useful it can be. So, Vice Chair Bonner, I'm handing the gavel to you, and I will be here if you need me. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Chair Schultz. And with that, I would like to call this meeting to order of the Health and Human Finance and Policy Division to order for Wednesday, March 23rd, 2022. The first order of business for today is to take the roll. Ms. Hansen.
And I'm just going to interrupt. Vice Chair Bonner, you need to speak up or maybe use a headset or talk very loud.
I'll try to speak up.
Very loud, still too quiet.
Is that better?
That's a little bit better.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep. All right, Ms. Hansen.
Yes. Good morning, everyone. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Lead Albright.
Good morning.
Good morning. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Burkle present.
Good morning, sir. Representative Fisher.
Fisher present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Representative Keel.
Keel present.
Thank you. Representative Liebling. Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Noor.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny present.
Representative Pearson.
Here.
Representative Pinto. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Sandel.
Present.
Thank you. And Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Thank you, members. Also, this is our 60th meeting. So exciting.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. It appears that a quorum is present. The next order of business for today is to approve the minutes. Do I have someone who would like to motion to approve the minutes for today?
Madam Chair, I would move the minutes from the previous committee hearing.
Thank you, Representative Albright. We will go ahead then and move the minutes for the March 22nd of 2022. Are there any corrections or comments to the minutes? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, and the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Our first agenda item for today is House File 3815. We have Chair Moran. Chair Moran, welcome to the committee.
Well, good morning. Good morning, Chair Bonner. It's good to be here. I miss you guys.
We miss you too, Chair Moran. All right. And with that, would you like to, we're going to make the motion to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in our finance and policy omnibus bill. Chair Moran, would you like to tell us about your bill?
Yes, Chair. So House File 3815 is a quality parenting initiative, which is a national movement to ensure that all children have care and care, have excellent parenting and lasting relationship so that they can thrive and grow. I'm going to call Quality Parent Initiative QPI. So QPI is built on the belief that excellent parenting is the best intervention for children that enables healing and development. This reform relies on the expert involvement of birth parents, relative caregivers, foster families, young people, and others in the child welfare system. QPI Minnesota launched in 2017 with support from Minnesota community-based foster care organizations and in concert with countless stakeholders, including several partner counties and support from DHS staff. QPI Minnesota provides training and technical assistance statewide for practices that bridge the gap between parents, social workers, and foster parents. For example, priority practices includes initial calls, which I carried a bill called Comfort Calls, which is really an awesome way of bridging that gap between foster parents and birth parents at placement to establish relationships and invite caregiving partnerships to support children in care. We have the circle of support meetings with relationship building between the bio and foster caregivers at the start of a placement. We always want to elevate youth leadership voices. One example is the youth voice brochure in your package that you can read through. Young leaders experienced in foster care developed this resource and related training for foster parents to improve support for young people in care. All of this important work, Madam Chair, to date has been funded by the philanthropic and contribution from 5 cornerstone counties and 10 founding community-based foster care organizations. House File 3815 supports the critical activities of training and technical assistance for partners across the state so that foster care reform movement continues to grow with the goal of supporting quality parenting for all children in foster and kinship care. So, Madam Chair, my first testifier is Sandy Weber, who is a QPI Minnesota parent.
All right. Thank you, Chair Moran. And we do have Ms. Weber.
Hello.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Weber. If you'd like to state your name, your affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Moran and committee members, for this opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 3815. My name is Sandy Weber, and I am an adoptive parent of a child adolescent who is currently 18. And I am also a mental health professional. I work as a school-based therapist in a school in North Minneapolis currently. But I also have a history of being a teacher, a special education teacher, and a school social worker. And I am an adoptive parent, like I said, of an 18-year-old, and it's a transracial adoption. My adoption journey began in 2015. And as I was starting to kind of think about adopting, speaking to people who are in the field and other friends who had adopted, I started that journey and considered children to adopt, and the daughter I currently care for was just this bright light that I kept looking at her face on the Minnesota waiting site. And Chair Moran, even as you were speaking about what this bill encompasses, I was just getting emotional because I was recalling some of our story and our journey together. So my daughter came to live with me in 2017 in the fall, and then the adoption was finalized in June of 2018. Mm-hmm. In January of 2018, she started to reach out to her birth mom and to her birth father. And for my initial reaction as a parent of an adopted child was just some of fear and of losing her. But I knew, because my mental health background and my experience with children for all the years that I worked as a teacher led me to know that I had to let this happen, because her narrative and her story about who she is just directly tied to her birth family, and that I couldn't expect her to live in isolation with me apart from that. So I just launched forward with her in that. And in fact, we had a family therapist who met with her birth mom and me for a couple times before meeting with my daughter and all of us together to kind of help bridge and heal some of the relationship. And then the journey just propelled forward from there. And I will say that it wasn't without a lot of difficulty and some conflict. And there's quite a few differences in how the story played out for both sides of my daughter's family. And we're in a really good place right now. But I launched forward with that. And that actually led to my daughter being in the QPI. But I have good voices of reason in my head, you know, directing me in how to proceed with the relationship with the birth family. But had I, or maybe other foster families, had the QPI knowledge and resources, I think that my journey would have been even easier, and her journey would have been even easier. I also think that there were professionals in my life, and there were other foster adoptive parents in my life telling me to do the opposite. And speaking about how she was my daughter now, and that was what the importance was. But I just knew in my heart and in my gut that I needed to let her have those relationships. And even though there was conflict, and even though there was some even more trauma that came out of it, for her, it was the road to healing, and it still is the road to healing for her and for her understanding who she is. And since she's been involved in QPI and being one of the youth voices, she has just, her healing has been even more, it's grown even more. And she's been able to voice her story, which is all a part of healing. Being able to share your story is a part of healing. And so she's been able to share her story with others who are going through what she's gone through. And also to know that she's an agent for change. The fact that she knows that she can be an agent for change has helped her just mature into this wonderful, like, outspoken, confident person. And every time that she has had the hour of QPI conversation with other youth, she just comes out of there saying, "Mom, I want to do things." She has an idea for building a business where she can partner animals with pre-adoptive families so that the child can have an animal as an object to relate to as they adjust to the home. Her brain has just begun, you know, thinking of all these things because of her involvement in this. And she's been able to speak out. When we were at the panel last week, she just kind of commands a stage. And after that, she was able to answer questions to parents and walk away, again, having goals for wanting to be a mentor and do things that will support both families and children in being able to have not just your adoptive family, but your birth family, all a part of your narrative and story. And I don't want to forget things, so I'm going to get on my phone here to make sure that I am remembering what I need to say. But I just want to really just let you know how powerful this experience has been. And when I look at other families who don't have this knowledge, foster families who are voicing what they think is good counsel to someone by saying they can see their parents when they're 18 or such things like that, that I know just really fosters secrecy. And my daughter has been always very open with me because I've allowed that. But I also know that there are families that, you know, kids are reaching out to their birth families with or without support, and they're finding ways. And so I just know that adoptive families and foster families need to be a part of protecting their children as they do that, loving them through that, allowing them to do that so there is not secrecy and divisiveness in the home, and that the children can feel like there is not some flaw in them because they still want to know those people and have connections with those people despite whatever trauma or issues that they experienced during the time that they were in their care. So
thank you, Ms. Weber. I really appreciate, you know, I know it takes a lot of courage and patience to walk that road with our children. And so I really appreciate that and your testimony here today. Thank you so much for that. We do have one additional testifier, Ms. Rickford.
Hi, thank you. My name is Kate Rickard, and I am the director of Quality Parenting Initiative Minnesota, and have been a supporter of QPI since its planning stages in 2016. Thank you, Chair Moran and committee members, for this opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 3815. QPI originated with community-based organizations coming together, really yearning to help families through partnership and mutual support for one another towards a common goal of excellent parenting. Early on, we realized the path needed to include youth and parents and foster parents as leaders for this work. And to that, I am proud to say that of our current 12 regional QPI leaders who are being trained right now, 6 of them have lived experience in the system, and 3 of them are Indigenous parents. There's incredible power in the practice of QPI. One of these practices, Representative Moran already had mentioned, was around the initial call or the comfort call. We worked together, QPI worked together with DHS on the training for the initial calls, and really that statute went into effect due to Representative Moran's leadership in 2020. When this call is done at the beginning stages of an out-of-home placement, our QPI survey data shows that foster parents are significantly more likely to believe they can partner with parents towards reunification than when first contact is made later. We see relationships with birth parents and foster families extend beyond reunification, as each parent becomes an extension of family when those early connections happen. This is what we want for our children and our communities. Embedded into all of the QPI practices is leveraging the power of relationship along with the wisdom of those who have experienced the system firsthand. One example, Sandy alluded to it, is our Youth Voices Action Work Group. The youth range from ages 13 to 24 are diverse in culture, BIPOC, LGBTQ+, Two-Spirit, Metro, Greater Minnesota, and have a range of fostering experiences, whether it's non-relative, relative, aged out, parenting while in care. And this group is an inspiration to work with and have a lot of passion to create change in a system that left them with some missed opportunities and emotional wounds to repair. Just last week, they presented twice. One was a national webinar on how to leverage youth in leadership, as well as the MSSA annual conference. And I witnessed social workers and foster parents asking them questions on how they can better support children in care. One of the questions was, what do I do when my child is crying for their mom at bedtime? Like this question, right? Like those youth had the opportunity to answer what it was like for them to miss their parent. We have this great supportive adult leader of the group. And, you know, she's a current social worker, had been a former kid in care. And then she could swoop in and offer the tangible items such as, have mom record her voice so that if we're not able to connect on a call before bedtime, the children can still hear you. Like that is like system change at the ground level. And really, this is what QPI is about, how we learn and partner together for better outcomes. When individuals work together, you can address system issues more effectively. One of our other examples is, you know, we've been hearing from our regional leaders that they're needing more support and strategies when using the initial calls with relatives. And so in response, we're looking at how do we create a practice guide that is specifically addresses what is it like to have that call happen with relatives where maybe there's some distance between them or there's conflict or it's running really smooth. But again, we're looking at like what can we do on the impact for families right there and then. To date, QPI has relied on the philanthropic community.
Ms. Rickford, if you could try to wrap it up. I'm sorry, we do have to make sure that we keep concise. We have lots of bills to get through today, and so we need to remind testifiers and members to keep things tight, if we could.
Yes, I have like one last little sentence, if it's okay.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, so this House file is a small investment for the state, but will yield big transformation for our kids and our families. And so I just want to thank you for the support. Thank you for the consideration on behalf of all the individuals who have been participating in QPI.
Thank you, Ms. Rickard. I really appreciate your testimony here today. Do we have any member questions before we give it to Chair Moran for closing comments? I do not see any. So Chair Moran, would you like to close?
Yes, thank you, Chair Bonner. Just want to just reiterate again that House File 3815 supports the critical activities of training and technical assistance for partners across the state so that this foster care reform movement continues to grow, that it creates safe and stable growth in our children and our young ones, but it's also a partnership with the goal of supporting quality parenting for all children in foster and kinship care. Thank you so much for your consideration of the bill and for hearing it today and for your support.
Thank you, Chair Moran. And with that, I would like to renew my motion that we lay over House File 3815 for possible inclusion in the Finance and Policy Omnibus. Next on the schedule today, we have House File 4217, Representative Agbaje. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. So today I'm here to present House File
4217. Oh, yes. Hold on one second. We do need to make sure that we get the bill before the committee. Welcome. I just want to make a motion that we are going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill. And with that, I'm going to bring House File 4217 before the committee. Representative Agbaje, if you would like to proceed and explain your bill.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate that. This bill is an issue that's been led by advocates and community-based providers who support children being placed with relatives should they be removed from the home, and also recognizes the need to recruit and support foster parents who reflect the cultural and communities of children in care. The bill reflects the two priorities of kinship care and focused recruitment of foster parents from Black, Indigenous, and wider communities of color. Section 1 and 2 of the bill encourage and support agencies in finding support and engaging relatives for children in care. And Section 3 supports a grant program designed to recruit foster and adoptive families of color and encourage tracking of plans and data in that area. So it is true that sometimes a child cannot stay with their parent for a number of reasons. And if that is the case, then care or placement with a relative is the right option. It provides continuity for the child, reduces trauma, and often increases placement stability. And according to 2020 federal data, 43% of Minnesota's children are in foster care or with relatives. And this is a data point that we want to continue to improve. When a child can't be placed with relatives, placement in a foster family is often the next best step. But in Minnesota, we have significant overrepresentation of children of color in foster care, particularly Indigenous children, African-American children, and multiracial children. And they are in care at much higher percentages than other child populations in the state. And so this bill would fund grants to support recruitment and engagement of foster and adoptive families of color, track data on the race and ethnic background of families served, and require capacity building from DHS to the field on both relative search and engagement and recruitment of families who reflect the children who are in our care system. This bill, we're currently in conversations with DHS on the technical assistance that they've provided, and we hope that as this bill moves forward, we can incorporate some of those things. So today you'll hear from two testifiers, and I believe the first one is Curtis Bell.
Thank you, Representative Agbaje. And I believe we have Mr. Bell on today.
Yes, I am here.
Hello, Mr. Bell. If you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good morning. My name is Curtis Bell, and I want to thank Madam Chair and committee members for hearing my testimony today and giving me this opportunity to come before you. Again, my name is Curtis Bell, and my wife is Darlene. And we've been foster parents for the past 34 years. We have 8 children and 3 biological and 5 adopted. We have also adopted or fostered over 30 kids in our career as foster parents. And 5 of them we've adopted out of foster care while maintaining busy professional lives as well as serving as community and faith-based leaders. My wife and I both serve as QPI champions for Minnesota and to assist with reshaping the child welfare policies that impact the quality of care for our children. My wife, Darlene, works as a national representative for the Youth Law Center and the QPI National Office. So we're no stranger to the child welfare system. Darlene and I, we were kinship caregivers for our first 2 adopted kids, and they came by way of our own cousins not being able to care for their kids and we became foster parents so that we can raise our own children, bring our own kids into our own family, which, you know, we understood the dynamics of kinship at the time. And we got to see firsthand the differences between kinship care and foster care and the lack of support provided to kinship versus that of foster care, as well as we saw stresses that were imposed upon families being asked to take on this expanded role. So we knew firsthand what that was like. As a child, I lived in Chicago, and I experienced trauma by losing my mom at a young age. And that's when I was taken from foster care in Chicago to move to Minnesota as a child. So I learned what kinship care was all about when my grandmother raised me without compensation. My experiences that I speak about makes me even more passionate about foster care. And because I have this lived experience, I see firsthand the good, the bad, and the unfortunate part of the child welfare systems. But our goal today is to take that good to great, take the bad to great, and take the unfortunate to fortunate. Some of my observations that I've been, as I've been going along this journey of foster care and kinship care, as I attend meetings, trainings, conferences, and community events, I observe that very little focus has been given to ensure that foster and kinship homes are culturally prepared for the predominantly ethnic groups that are entering the child welfare system. This is a disproportionate number of Black, Indigenous, people of color children that are being placed in white foster homes and being adopted by white families, rather than being placed in homes that reflect their culture or ethnic groups. We personally have observed this unfortunate circumstance and had to go to court to have our culturally diverse adopted children's rightfully placed in our very own home. My wife and I had had the opportunity to participate in targeted recruitment efforts in our community forums and fairs, where we go and there's gathering of people of different backgrounds. And we were seeking to recruit potential foster parents from diverse communities. While trying to market this opportunity to become a foster parent, we often are faced with the challenges of overcoming the stigma of being resource parents for the child welfare system, because the community that we serve has seen their children removed at such an alarming rate. There is distrust between the Black community because the perception is that the system is there to take away their children. So the community needs assurances from the county, state, and federal levels to know that our first priority is the safety of the children, then the reunification of the family, and that we will provide support to assist in recovering unfortunate circumstances, but this will be done with cultural sensitivities to suit the child's needs. Our children are our highest priorities. When foster care is needed, we want to support our children to receive their greatest comforts, and for them to know that from our interactions with them, we care about them deeply as individuals. This includes honoring their culture and striving to welcome them into homes with culture norms. And I can tell you from all these perspectives that there is a significant value that I see that when foster and kinship are in the parents and we reflect that in their care, we know our communities already are underrepresented as foster parents and overrepresented as children in the foster care system. And I believe that House Bill 4217 can improve our foster care system by adding focused recruiting efforts for Black, Indigenous, and wider communities of color without proper data from current and prospective foster parents. We cannot determine which aspects of recruitment and retention need to be altered or strengthened without this bill.
Mr. Bell,
yes, ma'am.
If I could ask you to try and wrap up your testimony, we have some additional testifiers, and I want to make sure they have an equal opportunity to speak.
Yes, ma'am. One more sentence, and I'll be done. With this additional support, child welfare system agencies can improve matching, promote placement stability, enhance racial equity among foster and kinship care, and more. Mm-hmm. Recommending this bill would implement data-driven recruitment and retention practices, specifically in robust foster care census to help agencies determine whether foster care parents are being fully utilized, identify the gaps in recruitment strategies, and target recruitment efforts based on statistically accurately profiles of successful foster parents like ourselves to inform for further data collection and local stakeholders. So again, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to present and talk with you on this topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. And we have a Ms. Boo. Ms. Boo, and I just want to remind testifiers to please keep your comments concise. We want to make sure that all testifiers get the equal opportunity to share their thoughts and perspectives. So we really do appreciate you keeping your thoughts tight. Thank you so much. Ms. Boo?
Thank you, Chair Bonner and Representative Ekbaje. I will do my best to keep it brief. We at the North American Council on Adoptable Children are working with Aspire Minnesota on this bill, and I'm grateful to Kirsten Anderson for that. I also want to thank DHS for providing important feedback for us on the bill. NACAC works to ensure that children have families and that foster, adoptive, and relative families can support the children in their care. We work with more than 2,000 families here in Minnesota currently. And HF 4217 is designed to ensure better outcomes for children. Relative care has been shown to increase stability for a child, improve behavioral and mental health outcomes, and decrease the likelihood of reentry into care. Good practice involves not just finding and notifying relatives, but also supporting them as they move forward. And this bill will provide technical assistance on how to do that. When a child can't be placed with relatives, placement in a foster family is the next best thing if they can't go home. In the most recent Federal Child and Family Services Review, Minnesota was identified as needing improvement in this area. The review says, quote, Minnesota has a severe shortage of foster homes for all children, especially for African American and Native American children, unquote. Federal law requires states to provide for the recruitment of potential foster adoptive families that reflect the ethnic and racial diversity of children for whom homes are needed. But we're not succeeding at this currently. According to data provided informally by DHS staff during a recent meeting, of non-relative foster parents, 8% are American Indian compared to 19% of children in care. 4% are African American compared to 14% of children in care. And the state has 10 times more children who speak Spanish than homes where a caregiver speaks Spanish. The goal with this bill is to ensure that when family placement is needed, agencies have a full range of options whenever possible in the child's community or tribe. When we have more potential families, agencies are able to choose the family that can best meet all of the child's needs, including their cultural and language needs, as well as the needs resulting from the reason they've entered care. With this bill, we can improve our state's ability to engage relatives for children in care and increase the number of foster adoptive parents. And we can comply with federal law by ensuring the pool of prospective parents better reflects the population of children who need a family. Thank you so much for your time, everyone.
Thank you, Ms. Boo, for your testimony. Do we have any questions from members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ogbajay, a couple of questions. The first is, do we have data today about the pool of families willing to provide these services?
Representative Ekbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. Sorry, could you repeat the question? I missed the first part of it.
Sure. Just wondering if we have data about the pools of families that would be willing to provide these services.
Yes. So I believe that there is information about families that would be available to provide these services, as we heard from Mr. Bell. I think there's a number of people who would be very interested in doing this. My understanding from previous work I've done in this area is that sometimes there are barriers to access for more families who would want to get involved in the foster care system. And so I hope that this bill would be one of those ways to kind of decrease those barriers. And I don't know if Ms. Boo or Mr. Bell would want to add anything further.
I can add just a little bit that surveys nationally have certainly shown that more Indigenous and African American families do already and are willing to care for children in foster care and adoptive and relative care. Again, they already are stepping up, and then I would just add that, as you just mentioned, and as Mr. Bell mentioned, that there are barriers to overcome, which is why this targeted recruitment can be particularly helpful, both the distrust of the system that has taken more children that are of color than are white has created some real barriers. And then there's other licensing barriers that the support can help them overcome.
And I would agree with Ms. Boo with the barriers aspect of it. And if we can have support to overcome those barriers, I think that the communities which we serve will be more apt to become foster parents in.
Thank you, Mr. Curtis. Representative Albright, did you have any follow-up on that?
Just a clarifying point and a question. Obviously, the improvement of the opportunity for foster parenting is laudable, and I certainly appreciate the testimony of Ms. Boo and Mr. Bell. Consideration for what this might and how this might affect the counties. I'm just wondering if because of this, this bill, would that create any new mandates or costs relevant to administering it at the county level? I'm wondering if the author of the bill or someone from either the county or DHS might speak to that.
I do want to, before we go forward, I just want to remind members that we are on a tight timeline and we do have a firm cutoff today. So just want to remind our members of that. And with that, Representative Agbaje or Ms. Boo, do you have a clarification for that?
Yes. So my understanding is that it would create a specialist that would help with the recruitment of families of color to become foster parents. We are working with DHS on ensuring that it doesn't create any unnecessary strain. This is something that a lot of groups are really interested in, and I believe the agency is interested in as well. So we'll be working with them to make sure that the counties understand their roles. And the cost is already, there's a grant program included in this bill. And so I think that would cover the initial costs for this.
Right. Thank you. Representative Albright.
So just to clarify, Representative Agbaje, the budget that you are suggesting, it looks like you're assuming that the grants will be ongoing and added to the base. But does that afford any opportunity to provide those grants for administration at the county level as well?
Representative Agbaje.
Yeah. Yes. So we'll probably be getting into that with DHS a little bit just to make sure that we're covering all of our bases, but that's a really good question. I believe the grant is originally for the programming aspect of it, and then we will work with them on to making sure that we're covering the additional operational costs.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Albright. Any closing comments, or do we have any other members with questions?
No, I appreciate Representative Agbaje bringing this bill forward. I think it's very important that we provide this service. But as always, I think what we do at the state certainly has ripple effects at the county and at the community level. We just want to make sure that we don't leave it's a chance, if you will, that the counties are going to take this upon themselves without the proper funding. And so with that, Madam Chair, I would urge us to move forward and be brief in our comments for future. We do have a tight timeline, as you said.
All right. Thank you, Representative Albright, for the good questions. And thank you, Representative Agbaje. I am not seeing any additional hands up. So Representative Agbaje, would you like to do some closing comments?
Any closing comments would just be thank you to Representative Albright for his questions. I think those are all very good. We are still working with DHS to get the fine-tuning correct, and just appreciate everyone's support on moving this forward to making sure that our foster parents and caregivers reflect the communities of our children that are in the care system. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Representative Agbaje. And with that, I will lay over House File 4217 for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance and Policy Omnibus. And with that, next on our agenda, we have House File 3477. Representative Vang, And I want to state that my motion is to lay over House File 3477 for possible inclusion in the Finance and Policy Omnibus. Welcome, Representative Vang. Would you like to speak to your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 3477 is a pretty simple bill. It gives one-time appropriation of about $160,000 to Headway Emotional Health Services to support transportation costs for students in day treatment during non-school days. First, they are statutorily required to provide day treatment services 12 months out of the year. Transportation during the school year is provided by school districts. However, on non-school days, they have to pay for transportation using a ride service, which is about $150,000 on non-school days last year. This is an opportunity to explore relationships outside of or in addition to the school district's determined transportation funding would support transportation one day in January, one day to March, 9 days in June, 20 days in July, 20 days in August, one day in October, and one day in November. And this funding will put them in a better place to financially serve additional kids who really need these services. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll yield my time to my testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Representative Vang, for that introduction. And we have, Pat Dale here to testify?
And I am, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Pat. And before we start, I just want to remind testifiers to try and keep their comments brief and confine it to about 2 minutes, if you could, to keep us on schedule for today. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Pat Dale. I'm the CEO of Headway Emotional Health Services. Headway provides emotional health services throughout the 7-county metro area. We have 3 physical locations in Richfield, Brooklyn Center, and Hopkins. We are asking in House File 377 to provide support for transportation for the 2-day treatment programs we operate, one in Hopkins, one in Brooklyn Center. They are focused on middle and high school students whose emotional health issues have resulted in multiple negative experiences, including poor academic performance, high absenteeism, social and emotional isolation, suicidal ideation and attempts, disruptive family relationships, and multiple unsuccessful mental health interventions. Our day treatment is unique in that it focuses on emotional health as its primary cause. As a result, we are the best or only option for students with these issues living in the 7-county metro area. As a result, our transportation and catchment area is far larger than the traditional day treatment program, which tends to focus on a single school district or 2 school districts that are aligned simultaneously. We are requesting $160,000 to support the cost of transportation, as Representative Vang pointed out. There are 53 days of which there is no academic instruction. Currently, statute requires transportation on school days only, and that leaves providers scrambling to provide transportation on the days that kids are needing service and to not be able to get service just because there's no academic instruction results in causing challenges for us in their recovery. Thank you for your attention to this bill. Passing it would be, or laying it over would be, a first step in helping Headway continue to provide the best level of support to students and families. I am happy to answer any questions or provide any other additional information. With that, then our second speaker is a parent whose child successfully completed one of our 2-day treatment programs, and would yield my time to him.
Thank you, Mr. Dale. With that, I do have here a Mr. Peterson.
Yes, that's correct.
Mr. Peterson, if you'd like to go ahead and state your full name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Alan Peterson, and I live in Shakopee, Minnesota, and I work in a local car dealership. I'm appearing today to offer a very personal perspective regarding Headway. In 2020, my family made the very difficult decision to place my teenage daughter, Addie, in residential mental health care facility treatment due to her numerous suicide attempts and significant mental health issues. And also hospitalizations. This lasted most of the year, and that's where she lived. She made a lot of progress, and she was able to complete the treatment in that particular program. After completion, she needed a transitional space because after living in a mental health care facility, she needed to transition into going to school, living at home again, and we needed some help with that. And Headway provided that help. And the experience that my family had with Headway was nothing short of exceptional. Every single person made my daughter Addie and I feel welcome and safe and at home. And during the program, Addie progressed and she healed. And my ex-wife and I are so thankful for everyone at Headway and the program. One of the things that helped us out a lot, because we are divorced and we live in two separate cities, was the transportation. And that was really helpful to us so that we could work our hours at work and help get the care that our daughter needed. That was fantastic. It wasn't available all the time, but when it was available, it was just wonderful. And I'm happy to say that Addie graduated the program at Headway. She's currently a senior in high school, and she's going to graduate very soon here, and she's applying to a state college in the fall. And I can personally vouch for how critical the treatment that she received at Headway is. I honestly do not know where she would be or where really my family, what it would look like without Headway and the staff there today. So I wanted to provide that feedback, and thank you very much for listening, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Mr. Peterson. Do we have any member questions for either Representative Vang or for either of our testifiers? None? All right. Then, Representative Vang, I'll give you a moment if you'd like to make some closing remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Just want to thank you for your time, and I look forward for your support.
All right. And with that, I am going to lay over House File 3477 for inclusion in the health or the Human Services Finance and Policy Omnibus. Thank you, Representative Vang. And next on our agenda is House File 4273. And I'm going to make a motion to lay over House File 4273 for possible inclusion in our Finance Omnibus Bill. Representative Pryor, welcome to the committee, and I see that you have an A1 amendment. Would you like us to adopt your amendment to get your bill into shape?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like that amendment moved. Thank you.
All right. Fantastic. With that, in order to get this in the shape that the author would like it, we're going to go ahead and vote on the A1. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? All right. And with that, the A1 is adopted. So Representative Pryor, if you'd like to go ahead and proceed with explaining your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 4273 came forward from the Accessibility Task Force. It's addressing Medicaid for employed people with disabilities, also known as MAEPD. And this is a critical Medicaid program in our state. It makes it possible for people who have disabilities and need long-term care supports to receive needed Medicaid services while also working and making income, saving for retirement, like workers who don't have disabilities do. Minnesota introduced this program around the year 2000, and it's time for an update. Really, there are four problems that this bill addresses. First is the premium schedule kicks in at quite low incomes and is very regressive. Second, the asset limit hasn't kept up with the current needs for savings, including things like buying a home or starting a business. The third, Medicare premium reimbursement has a cliff. And I do have a testifier, Brittany Wilson, who will tell her story of how devastating this cliff is. And finally, the program can be administratively challenging for both enrollees and the agencies that are administering it. MAEPD is a really important tool for our state to ensure that people who have disabilities are not financially penalized for working. And HF4273 includes a set of needed reforms to strengthen it, which also makes it more likely that our communities will benefit from the many talents and experiences of community members who have disabilities. So just real briefly to walk through the bill, the first section is addressing the asset limits, going from $20,000 to $40,000 with inflationary adjustment. The second, the bill goes on, is in adjusting the premium schedule. It's also taking into account other health insurance payments. And finally, streamlining administrative aspects of the program, including some changes and what happens when a payment isn't made on time. And many of the points that were introduced in the amendment, it's incorporating some technical assistance that we had, which was important to the bill. So at this point, with your permission, Madam Chair, I would like to turn it over to my testifiers to really talk about the impact of this program and why it's so important to make these improvements.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. And just a point of clarification, I may have misspoke earlier. I was, in fact, moving the amendment, not yes. Representative Pryor, who is not a member of the committee. So just want to make that clarification. It sounds like I may have mixed my words there, so wanted to be clear on that particular point so we follow proper procedure. And with that, we do have your first testifier, Ms. Wilson. Ms. Wilson, if you could step up and ask or go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. And again, I ask that we try to keep our remarks to about 2 minutes.
Good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify in a bill that is very near to my heart. My name is Brittany Wilson. I live and work in St. Paul and have been gainfully employed and on MAEPD for nearly a decade. I was born with a joint and muscle condition and navigate life using an electric wheelchair. Growing up with a disability and in the system, my main goal was to be financially independent. I dreamed of owning my own home, working, and enjoying life. When I graduated from college, I moved from St. Cloud to St. Paul. It was such an exciting time, being in my younger 20s, knowing that I had the rest of my life ahead of me. But there was also a feeling of being stuck. I knew that if I made too much money, I would be kicked off of Social Security and state services that I need, including the CADI waiver and PCAs. Through the Disability Hub, I learned about MAEPD and my life changed. I called my mom right after discovering that I qualified, and I was thrilled to explain that I could find a job, work, earn a livable competitive wage, and still get the help that I need. I couldn't believe it, and I felt so lucky and still do to live in a state where this program is available. I applied for MAEPD and was informed that I needed to apply for Medicare. I had no problem getting on Medicare as I had been disabled my whole life. I started working entry-level jobs where I was making around $14 an hour, and as I grew professionally, my wages increased. One day, I received a letter from the federal government explaining that I would need to start covering my Medicare Part B premiums in addition to my MAEPD premium. I had to make it work because independence and the fulfillment that working gave me was worth it. But I was barely making it by, and everything that I made went to my healthcare premiums. About 2 years later, I received another letter from the federal government informing me that they were no longer going to be paying my Medicare Part A premiums and that I would need to pay an additional $400 a month. And my world came to a halt. There was no way that I could pay over $700 a month for my health insurance and still be able to afford the basic things like rent and food. It became clear to me that I would be forced to quit my job and apply for all the services I had been working so hard to stay off of. No one should ever be forced to make that decision. When I called my county financial worker and told them my story, they said that there was nothing that they could do. I asked to speak with a supervisor and explain my situation, and their response was to give me food bank information. I was so frustrated and fed up, and most importantly, terrified for my future, but I refused to give up. I kept going up the chain of command and telling my story and begging for someone to hear me and to understand the position that I was in. I had my bank statements ready, all of my bills to prove the bottom line. And after a few weeks and many phone calls, I finally got to someone who had the power to make a decision. Their decision allowed me to stay on MAEPD and keep working, and it changed my life. It was the biggest relief to know that I would be allowed to continue to work and support myself. I'm not sure how many Minnesotans who have been put in a similar situation, but ever since I made a promise to myself, I vowed that one day I would help change the law, because no Minnesotan should ever be forced to choose between working and being reliant on a system for health care. I urge you to support House File 4273, which would allow folks to be reimbursed for Medicare premiums, among other common sense changes. MAEPD is such an important program because it allows people with disabilities to work and live just like everyone else. But as you can hear from my story, it needs to work better for everyone. House File 4273 is the result of months of collaboration and input from people who use the program. Please hear our stories and recognize that there are barriers that are put in the system that stop people from living their full potential, that make people choose between the impossible. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Wilson. I just want to thank you for your courage to come testify before us today and your incredible persistence and passion to continue with this work. I know it can be an uphill battle and a real struggle to sort of fight back against the system when it's not working for you. So thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate you coming. All right, with that, we do also have one additional testifier, Mr. Widlick or Wudlick?
Wudlick, yeah.
Wudlick, my apologies. If you'd like to go ahead and state your name, please try to keep your comments to about 2 minutes and go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rob Wudlick. I am a disability advocate that's employed, and I have a spinal cord injury. My background is in engineering, nonprofit work, entrepreneurship, and right now I work at University of Minnesota and doing clinical trial project management too. You know, today, this bill, I've been working on it for, trying to push this for years, and this bill to me is about equality and opportunity for those with disabilities. My personal vision has always been to contribute to my society, and that's primarily done through your occupation. And when I broke my neck 11 years ago, I became fully dependent on caregivers and state services through Minnesota Assistance. The MAEPD program really has created a great opportunity for me to work, contribute. I've done medical device consulting. I have my own company where I make assistive technology. I'm growing that into making a medical device soon. But all that requires ownership of wealth and more capital than I'm allowed to have. And so it's you know, kind of hard to justify this personal growth and ability to serve myself and others. It's a situation I don't think it's fair to be in. I want myself and others to kind of have the same opportunities as you and anybody else on this committee and in our community. One of the things I help manage a spinal cord injury peer group, and I've heard a lot of stories in all of these situations I'm going to list off here. Just imagine yourself becoming disabled and having to face. So, you know, legally not being able to hold enough assets to put a down payment on a house or a car. Purchasing a car nowadays, especially a vehicle, an adaptive vehicle, is about $80,000. Having to turn down employee stock options. Turning down raises for fear it would put you over the asset limits. Having a safety net to fall back on and going broke. Or generating self-sustainable wealth. Brittany tells a really compelling story too. And it just, there's so many things that are unfair about this program. I've lost one of the things that this modifies too is kind of a change from 6 months reporting to annual and giving some loan forgiveness if you miss your payments on time. This has happened to me. I'm in a wheelchair. I have limited use of my arms. I rely on others to help pay bills, and I've missed those payments and lost my services. And it's kind of a quick dash to get back on it, but it's a nightmare. So when it does happen, and I think the current system, I'm really glad that we have the MAPD program, but it's limiting individuals like myself, Brittany, and a lot of other people in our community from pursuing the American dream. And we want to contribute and help ourselves and help others. So thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So
thank you, Mr. Woodlick. And thank you. You know, I think we have some two incredible examples of folks who are really struggling within the system to do everything the right way, as we say, like to say, but really, and doing so with passion and compassion. I applaud you for having the courage to come and speak before us today. Thank you so much for that. Do we have any member questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Woodlick, it's good to see you again.
Thank you.
I appreciate your tenacity and your perseverance in this matter. Members, Mr. Woodlick's testimony, as well as from Ms. Wilson, pretty compelling in terms of what this legislature is all about, in terms of providing a best life for these folks that, through no choice of their own, are having to fight the very system that lays out the fact that they're trying to help. So I would urge members' support of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And I do not see any additional hands. Representative Pryor, would you like to make some closing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. MAEPD is a lifeline for working people living with disabilities. But this lifeline should not be a ceiling that holds working people in poverty because of barriers in the program. The provisions of House File 4273 come from the people who are using this program, and they identified the problems, but they've also come forward with the solutions. Let's do everything we can to facilitate people who have disabilities participating in the workforce. With our current shortages, this is more important than ever. So thank you, members, for the opportunity to present this bill. Thank you, testifiers, for coming forward and the work that you did to produce this bill, and all of the colleagues that you're speaking for. And we do hope to have your support.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. And with that, I will lay over House File 4273 for possible inclusion in the Finance Omnibus Bill. Next on our agenda today, we have House File 35. Representative Elkins, welcome. And the motion for this bill is to lay it over for possible inclusion in the Finance Omnibus Bill. Representative Elkins, I see that you have an A4 amendment. Would you like us to adopt your amendment and get the bill in the shape you'd like it?
I would like to. All of this that this amendment does is it changes a date from 2022 to 2023.
Perfect. Thank you. Then I will move that we amend House File 35 with the A4 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? All right. Very good. And the motion prevails and the amendment has been adopted. Representative Elkins, if you'd like to go ahead and proceed with explaining your bill as amended.
Great. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Yes, this bill would establish a grant program that would be administered by the Minnesota Council on Disabilities that would provide funding for small cities and counties with limited resources to bring their websites into compliance with the Americans with Disability Act. Right now, you know, most of these small cities and counties don't have the resources to meet ADA requirements. And so this grant program, which MCOT itself would administer with assistance from the cities and counties, would enable them to do that. So the intent is to create some template programs, some exemplars that other cities could copy to provide better access to people with disabilities to the information they need on city and county websites. So I think we have two testifiers. I think Mr. Turner from the Minnesota Council on Disabilities is going to testify, as well as Noah McCourt, who's a self-advocate.
All right. Wonderful. And I have first on my list Mr. McCourt. Mr. McCourt, if you would like to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. And again, I urge all of our testifiers to try and confine your remarks to 2 minutes, please.
Can everybody hear me all right?
All right. All right. We're having a little bit of disruption, but I think we can hear you.
Can everybody hear me all right now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. As Representative Elkins mentioned, my name is Noah McCourt, and I'm a disability advocate, as well as head of the Disability Justice Network here in Minnesota. And I'm here to testify in favor of House File 35, which aims to improve the state's IT, municipal IT infrastructures to make them more accessible to persons living with disabilities. It's been a pet project of mine for a few years. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 56.7 million people, nearly one in five Americans, lives with disabilities such as vision loss, hearing loss, and mobility impairments. People with disabilities face many challenges when websites are not accessible. For example, individuals who are blind may not be able to navigate a website using a screen reader. If the website doesn't properly label graphics, individuals who are deaf cannot always understand the narration in an online video. People with on the autism spectrum, such as myself, also experience challenges with executive functioning and motor skill challenges. For example, I often don't use a mouse when using a computer. Sensory processing issues also make it difficult to correlate the mouse to a screen. So oftentimes I'll use a tablet. When government entities fail to make their websites accessible, people with disabilities are unable to get access to important government services and information. Before being updated, the Minnesota Management and Budget Office hiring page required an individual to tab through the hiring page over 500 times. Unfortunately, this is not an uncommon issue. In Minnesota specifically, there are two sides to this issue. There's Minnesota Statute 16E.04, which establishes guidelines and processes for website accessibility, but it really only applies to state entities. And so this bill really brings municipal sites into a similar standard. And it really outlines the need for effective communication with people with disabilities. And Minnesotans with disabilities continue to be left behind in both regards. The internet is dramatically changing the way that we serve the public. Local government websites are particularly important because they offer citizens a wide variety of different services, including access to public officials. I actually filed the first digital lawsuits in Minnesota against Carbon County and several other cities. And in the first half of this year, there's actually been 1,053 suits across the nation, which is a 30% uptick from last year. Usually you see an increase in lawsuits when there's a new law. The ADA has been around for nearly 30 years. So the question is, why now? The first reason is that many potential plaintiffs have been waiting for the U.S. Department of Justice to issue their interpretation of the ADA in regards to websites. That really didn't happen. And in 2015, the DOJ decided to extend deadlines again, and a wave of lawsuits hit the federal court system last year and the next. The second reason lies in the way that websites have developed as we move forward as a society. The functionality of websites back in the day was very basic. They looked like posters. It was simple, but as the internet took off, accessibility became less and less of a factor, and the focus has declined by supporting and the focus has really been declined on access. By supporting municipalities and developing accessible designs, we're moving towards creating a more inclusive, open, and transparent government where information and services can be available to all Minnesotans. I am very grateful to Senator Elkins for championing this issue. Representative Elkins. And I really encourage the passage of House File 35. Thank you.
Chair, Madam Chair, you're muted.
Thank you for that. And Mr. Turner, if you'd like to proceed with your testimony again, please try to keep your comments brief and confine them to about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Bonner, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Trevor Turner, and I am the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. I also have a severe hearing loss and have been legally blind for over a decade. So digital accessibility is very important to me, both professionally and personally. The Minnesota Council on Disability is in strong support of House File 35, a bill that would provide grant funding to empower local governments with the tools and the training needed to ensure that their digital presence is accessible to Minnesotans with disabilities. As buildings need wheelchair accessible ramps and public signs need Braille alternative text, so does our public digital infrastructure need to be accessible to everyone. An example of digital accessibility that I use is in utilizing inverted colors on computer screens and closed captions when I'm watching videos or listening to audio. The digital realm is no longer a privilege for some, it's a right to all. And Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act and Chapter 363A of the Minnesota Human Rights Act mandate that our government and its services be accessible for everyone, and that must include public digital space. Much of government business nowadays is conducted digitally, and the COVID-19 pandemic has made it explicitly clear how important digital access is for local governments and their residents to interact with each other, ranging from snow emergency alerts to informational videos on public health, applying for permits, paying taxes and fines, and most importantly, participating in local civic discourse. Accessible government, especially digital government, allows for people with disabilities to live independently and engage with the community of their choice. We also recognize that smaller counties and towns may not have the resources necessary to ensure digital accessibility, so it's important for our state to support them and the residents of Greater Minnesota. The need is tremendous, but this bill is moving forward in the right direction. We appreciate the support of Representative Elkins on this bill and his unwavering support for the disability community, and we will continue to engage with stakeholders, including local governments and advocates, to ensure that the digital world is accessible to all. And thank you, Chair Bonner and members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Do we have any member questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Elkins, thank you for this bill. I recognize that this has been around for a while. Just a couple of questions for you. The first is recognizing that, as one of your testifiers said, technology is moving forward at light speed. But curious, since the ADA really mandated this to happen, not just at the state level, but the county level, why have the counties been unable to move forward on their own in this capacity and budget for it?
Well, some of the smaller counties, Madam Chair, sorry, Representative Albright, some of the smaller counties are kind of in the same boat as some of the smaller cities and don't really have the resources either, which is why we have a support letter in the record that is jointly presented by the Association of Minnesota Counties and the League of Minnesota Cities. I expect both of those organizations will be supporting the Council on Disabilities and implementing this bill.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Elkins, laudable that we provide, access to the funding. I'm just curious why there is a need for a new grant council when my sense is the Council on Disabilities could, I'm sure, afford the opportunity to review those grant applications, particularly when you're reducing the amount of grant money by 15% at a time when, as you said, some counties are looking for access to funding. That seems counterintuitive that you're taking money away from the very grant that would be supportive of those counties that are in need of the funds.
Representative Albright and Representative Bonner, or Chair Bonner. The reason this bill, which is numbered House File 35 and was in fact introduced on the first day of the session last year, has taken so long to get here is the first version of the bill had the Department of Administration administering the grant. And as you probably know, whenever the Department of Administration administers a grant, they take 15% off the top. So the reason that the bill is coming here late is that it was because for that reason heard in local government and state government finance last year. But when the council decided to take on the grant administration itself, the jurisdiction of the bill changed from state government finance to this committee. So the, it would still be a 15%, but it would be retained to support the Council on Disabilities' own administration of the grant, and the bill establishes a committee of staff that would be created by the Council on Disabilities to help them review the grant proposals.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a final comment. And Representative Elkins, you and I both have served on state government finance and certainly appreciate the streamlining nature of grants to afford those that are beneficial to them with, you know, the amount intended by the appropriation. So certainly applaud this effort, but I would also urge the Council on Disabilities to streamline this so that we can pump more money towards the folks that need it. 15% seems a bit on the heavy side for the work that might be needful and probably a protracted nature and not get the funds out to those that are needed in a more timely fashion. So with that, Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. I will also comment here that I know I have personally heard from many of my cities and counties that they would very much like to be in compliance, and they acknowledge that many of our services are moving online and that citizens really appreciate that, but they often lack the resources to do this. And I appreciate, Representative Elkins, you finding a way to create a template that may be reusable for other smaller cities and counties to leverage that ability to do that, even though they may not have those resources themselves. And with that, Representative Elkins, would you have any final comments?
No, Madam Chair, this is a good bill. I hope that it finds its way into the final omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Elkins. And with that, I am going to move that House File 35 be laid over for possible layover, I'm going to lay over House File 35 for possible inclusion in the omnibus. And last on our agenda for today is House File 4124. The motion will be to lay this bill over for inclusion. Representative Noor, I see that you have a DE1. Is that accurate?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the DE1 with your permission, Madam Chair.
Yes, I will go ahead and move the DE1. Would you like to explain briefly your amendment before we go to adopt it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this DE1 amendment puts the bill in the shape of that I want to present the bill, so it covers the entire bill presentation.
All right. With that, we'll go ahead then and take a vote. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right. And the motion prevails and the DE1 has been adopted. Then, Representative Noor, if you'd like to go ahead and speak to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. The Minnesota Family Investment Program provides economic security for families and children with basic needs and also helps the adults and the parents find the financial stability so that they can provide for their families. Madam Chair, members, this bill reduces the frequency of reporting from monthly a household to 6 months so that it's better aligned with other programs that we have. This bill also changes the budgeting process from retrospective to prospective. This, as I stated, also aligns with the reporting requirement for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or otherwise known as SNAP. Madam Chair and members, this bill will help us to streamline how we do reporting for the Minnesota Family Investment Program, creates an equitable access, and also dignified experience. Let me walk you through what happens when an individual applies for the MFIP program. You come in through the door. That's the first place you go to the Economic Security Office. You get the paperwork. You get to fill the combined application. We use a prospective budgeting to determine your eligibility. And then thereafter, we switch back to retrospective after the first initial months. Every individual in the, who is the head of household receives a monthly reporting form that they have to include their income or any change that may have happened. So I'll give you a scenario. When the individual reports that is considered the budget, the income month, so for example, which is the month of March, they're looking into the February income, and the budget month is this month of March for the benefit for the April. So which means things may have changed, incomes may have switched, or things other that does not see a much significant change, but then the burdensome process is the household receives a form, and if they don't return that form within the required timeline, they lose benefits. So this really helps us reduce the reporting button somewhere we don't see a significant change. It also creates a streamlined process and better experience for those recipients who are in need at that time. With that, Madam Chair, I do have two testifiers who will help us to present the bill. So thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Representative Noor. And do we have a Ms. Rosenberger?
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Rosenberger. And I will let members know, and just for the testifiers, we do have until noon. So we do need to make sure that we keep our comments tight so we have plenty of time to finish up today.
Well, thank you. And again, good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. So my name is Kristen Rosenberger, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and External Engagement at Greater Twin Cities United Way. And it's a pleasure to be here today to testify in support of House File 4124. At Greater Twin Cities United Way, our mission is to unite changemakers, advocate for social good, and develop solutions to address the challenges that no one can solve alone. And last year, we touched over 500,000 lives across the 9-county metro area and funded over 100 service organizations and coalitions that do amazing work every day to support our communities. Organizations like St. Paul Promise Neighborhood, which is one of our highly valued nonprofit partners and is testifying alongside us today. And together, we are working to advance pathways towards economic independence for working families from low-wealth households. And addressing the benefits cliff was elevated as a top priority by our nonprofit partners, who see it as a primary barrier to increasing family income and achieving financial stability. And we see these cliffs occur when benefits are lost due to a small increase in income, but result in a net income loss for the family, and that causes them to backslide financially. So with the growing demand and need for workers, it's important that we support pathways towards better jobs, better wages, and increased hours, rather than penalizing people taking advantage of improved employment opportunities. So short-term public benefits like the Minnesota Family Investment Program, or MFIP, can really help families get back on their feet to pay for housing, food, childcare after a temporary job loss or crisis. House File 4124 will help stabilize their benefits, allowing workers to pursue the education, training, and career support needed to expand their capacity for higher wage employment. It would eliminate unnecessary administrative burdens that cause barriers to family, and it would align reporting requirements with the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, for strong quality control measures. These small changes to MFIP reporting will reduce barriers and encourage a thriving workforce, a thriving economy, and most importantly, thriving families. Thank you to Representative Noor for your support for this issue and the committee members for your time today.
Thank you so much, Ms. Rosenberger. And with that, I also have a Ms. Jacot?
Yes.
If I'm saying that correctly.
Close enough.
My apologies. Go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
All right. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Megan Jacot, and I work at the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood. For over 10 years, SPPN has worked to promote racial and economic justice so every child in St. Paul can live a great life, pursue the career of their choice, and build wealth for their family. Today, I am testifying in support of House File 4124 by sharing a story from one of our families in the neighborhood. This parent recently participated in our six-month People's Fellowship to learn financial literacy and chart a path to building wealth and assets for the future. This parent plans to attend Normandale Community College, pursue a degree in business administration, receive her realtor's license, and ultimately start her own business. Though she currently works at Amazon and has recently had to cut back her hours to have the time to move her education and career plan into action, all while still caring for her young three-year-old son. She's turned to MFIP for support, hoping the program will help her fill in the gaps to make ends meet as she works to build a better future for her family. Yet, her income and MFIP benefit have fluctuated through this life transition. The turmoil of being unable to predict her monthly income has been stressful and honestly quite disincentivizing. She is working to become more financially independent, yet feels penalized for doing so, given the repercussions under the current system. Her story is one of many we hear from families working toward a brighter future. So please consider House File 4124 as a strong foundation from which families can climb higher. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jekut. And with that, I do have on the list one additional testifier, Natlitha Sumo. Is she here for testimony? All right. I do not see her here. All right. Then we're going to go straight to questions with just 5 minutes left, members. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Knorr, for bringing this bill. I generally support families not having to calculate this every month. I think we're headed in the right direction here, but I do have some questions about exactly how the prospective budgeting would work. So I just wondered if you could talk for a little bit about the model, because my understanding is the federal model is only used for those first 2 months. So if we're going to use it for prospectively 6 months, I would just like to know what goes into that calculation. I looked in your DE and in the bill, and there was nothing talking about exactly how it's calculated. So if you could address that.
Representative. Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Representative Knorr, go ahead.
Thank you so much, Representative Robbins. I think you asked a good question. The MFIP program is a combination of state and federal program because we combined the SNAP, the food program, and the cash into one. So the MFIP program is basically a state program. And when we make it the prospective budgeting, which is the first 2 months when you come in through the door, we use prospective budgeting. And then thereafter, we push back to retrospective, which means it's the way that we set up through our state system. It's not a federal mandate that can be corrected by the experts who are with us from the Department of Human Services, but through my experience, it's more burdensome to use retrospective budgeting. And quite frankly, this is a state process whereby we're going to be looking into future in terms of how much income you're making without looking into that, you know, small fluctuations when you get the third paycheck, when you get two checks or whatever it may be. And I would like to defer more explanation to the expert, Ms. Schlick, who is here with us.
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Bonner and Representative Robbins and committee members. So prospective budgeting looks at what is known as the person is applying or beginning a new eligibility period about their income, what can be anticipated. So it's possible that in a month someone's applying, their income is, I'm going to use made up numbers, $100, but they know next month that there's going to be extra shifts and it'll be $200. So whatever is known and can be anticipated is incorporated in setting the benefits. And then that it, that in the bill that Representative Knorr has introduced would be reviewed and recalculated every 6 months.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Schlick. So just so I understand, what actually goes into the calculation? Because it will always be forward looking. So what will they always be just anticipating in the next 6 months? My experience of this is that it's hard for people to know exactly what their income will be over that length of time. So I'd like to understand the particulars that will go into calculate this. And then if they're off, what happens on overpayments or underpayments? How will that be addressed?
I do want to point out to members that we have 1 minute and we have a hard stop due to session. Ms. Schlick, if you can speak very briefly, and then we'll have to move on, I'm afraid.
We could follow up with Representative Robbins on more detail, but basically that volatility you're describing, it would protect folks with earnings from that sort of volatility. Right now, their benefits are changing every month, and they're changing based on information that's 2 months old about their income.
All right. With that, I am going to have to wrap us up, members. We are going to be laying over House File 4124 for possible inclusion in the House Omnibus and Finance Policy Bill. And hopefully, Ms. Schlick and Representative Knorr, you can get back to Representative Robbins about any additional follow-up on this issue. And with that, members, we are adjourned for today.